the fitter that you can be and the preparations that you make will enable you to enjoy it to the absolute maximum. I truly believe that.
Prepare as much as you can.
Today on the podcast, we have Mags and Ollie. Mags is based in Chamonix in the French Alps and lives at the foot of Mont Blanc, which is the start/finish of the famous multi-day trekking route known as the Tour de Mont Blanc. So Mags is a legend online. And legends don't need last names, just Mags. Hey, her website is omnipresent, because if you Google many Tour de Mont Blanc search phrases, you will end up on her site, tourdemontblanchike.com. Welcome to the Hike Strong podcast.
Hi, Marcus. Thanks for having me today.
Sure. And then we have Ollie. So Ollie is the operations director managing the running of all the trips for Adventure Base. So in a video on the Adventure Base website, Ollie states what he likes most about his job, and that is watching people achieve things that they perhaps didn't think were possible. Hey, Ollie also states three key principles they live by at Adventure Base: provide daring adventures that create human experience, all with effortless organization. And he goes on to say, we do this because we believe life is better when you've been in the mountains. He's been with Adventure Base since 2014. Welcome to the podcast, Ollie.
Thanks, Marcus. Good to be here.
Now, tell us how you guys collaborate to help travelers successfully complete a TMB adventure.
We used to work in the same office as Mags, and she was always super passionate about the TMB, and Adventure Base sort of started selling TMB experiences a few years ago. Sort of during that time, we got to know Mags at the same time, and she was just this fountain of knowledge, and she sort of set up her own blogs and websites and all the rest of it. And at some point, there became a moment when I guess there was a discussion around, you know, can we work together? Is there a way that we can help Mags sort of reach an audience and sort of help deliver trips? Because of course, Mags runs an amazing blog, but she doesn't necessarily have the functionality to process payments and, yeah, sort of look after the full package of a trip. So we found it to be a really great combination of Mags's knowledge and our sort of logistical operation that we have in Chamonix.
Okay, that makes sense. Yeah, Mags, any thought on that?
Yeah, no, exactly. So, you know, my adventure started around 5 years ago when I hiked the TMB with my 10-year-old daughter and my 65-year-old mother. I also have another blog, family adventure blog called The Family Freestylers. And I, you know, we did the trek and I wrote a number of blog posts on our experience. And I didn't really think much more about it. However, from there, I got so much traffic and so many people contacting me, asking me questions. And I think it really related to people that I had hiked it with my 10-year-old daughter and a 65-year-old mother. So I was really having to research really hard before I went, because I felt this great responsibility for the two partners going with me. So yeah, you know, I think it kind of grew from that. And then I built the blog, the Tour de Mont Blanc hike.com website from that. And then I met these two amazing guys, Charlie and Ollie, that run Adventure Base. And, you know, I plan, well, everything on my website is basically for independent trekkers. So I work a lot with independent trekkers that come to me for advice and do Zoom sessions. But that also works really well with Adventure Base, because, you know, they assist with booking the self-guided treks on the itineraries that we both share now. And also they do the guided treks as well. So it works really well, doesn't it, Ollie? You know, it's a great feeling helping people get out there, giving them reassurances about the TMB, you know, before they leave.
Sure. Well, Mags, you call the Tour de Mont Blanc the most iconic trail in Europe. So Ollie and Mags, so make your pitch for why someone should pick the TMB if they could only make one trip in 2024 or 2025.
I don't think there are many other circular treks that go through three countries in Europe with such different cultures. For one, just the scenery is staggering. I've done it countless times and I still look at the scenery sometimes and it is literally like a painting. It does not seem real. And I think what's lovely is, you know, trekking through the three different countries, you get a real kind of immersion into different cultures and the food and the people. So I don't think there's any other trek like it, to be honest.
Okay.
It's a real shame I let you go first, Max, because that's more or less what I was going to say. Yeah, I couldn't agree more. The fact that you, like Max said, you travel through three different countries in the space of 10, 11 days or however long you're going to take to do it. Sort of the vibrancy of Chamonix, if that's your start point, is just a unique town. It's a mountain town like I've never seen anywhere else. It's buzzing, it's alive, it's full of people going off on all kinds of different adventures, and highly recommend to anyone who's doing it to always spend a couple of days before or after or both. I'm just sort of soaking up life in Chamonix. Of course, the other towns and villages along the way are also special, but to me, I guess I'm slightly biased because I live in the valley, but yeah, I think Chamonix is a really unique sort of selling point of doing the trip. Other than that, just echoing what Meg said,
okay,
every day is absolutely stunning.
I think it's great that you've got a focal point of Mont Blanc as well. I mean, you don't see her every day on the trail, and some people don't realize that before they set off. The fact that you do glimpse her here and there is a real focal point, isn't it, Ollie?
Yeah, and to see the different size of Mont Blanc. To some, it might not seem so obvious, but when you look at Mont Blanc from the south, from the Courmayeur side, it's super dramatic with this sheer rock coming out of the ground all the way up. Whereas if you look from Chamonix, you have more glaciers because it's north facing, so it's a little bit whiter. Yeah, and just seeing it from every possible angle is super cool.
So this is a good time to segue into talking about the fact that the TMB does not require technical mountain climbing skills to complete it. Do many travelers believe the TMB to be technical before researching or no?
I think people have a fairly good understanding of what they're getting into from the people that we talk to. I think there's an awareness that you're not going to the top of Mont Blanc. I think a few people do confuse that, but it's a very small minority. We're very clear there is a big difference between trekking the Tour de Mont Blanc versus climbing to the summit. But yeah, I don't know, what would you say, Max, from people you speak to?
Yeah, I think most people realize that it's a trek. I think some people underestimate the equipment needed early in the season. They often expect that you can trek the trail and it'll be all nice and green in June, when actually there's a lot of snow still on the trail in June, and so extra equipment can be necessary. So I think that's probably the biggest issue with a misunderstanding of equipment.
Okay. And Ollie, you were saying something before we started about the snow. Go ahead and comment on that, would you?
Yeah. So just touching on what Mag said. So early season TMB can be sort of at the mercy of what type of snowfall we've had towards the end of the winter. So to give an example, last June, there was still a fair amount of snow on some of the higher passes, some of the higher cols. And that's just a knock-on effect of, you know, a lot of snowfall in April and May around here. So in general, we've had a fairly dry winter when it comes to lower down in the valley, but actually the snowfall sort of above 2,000 meters, so about 6,000 feet, I guess, for your North American listeners, it's actually been pretty substantial. And we only really have a good idea of how sort of early June is going to look like, sort of come April, early May time. We can have a decent snowfall now, and then we could have 6 weeks of sunshine and warm temperatures, and it can all melt fairly quickly. But yeah, I guess it's just an awareness for people who are planning to come.
Can I just jump in here? Because the trail officially opens on the 14th of June. So many people just assume, right, brilliant, that's us, we'll book in June. But yeah, I would say most winters, I mean, I think, was it 2000, a couple of years ago, wasn't it? Was it? I can't remember the exact year that was completely dry and it was, you know, no snow at all. But most years you do have snow on the trail for the first 3 weeks. And I think that, yeah.
Okay. So now let's look at the opposite perspective. So let's say somebody's researching and they're like, I'm not comfortable in snow, I don't want to wear crampons. Typically, what weeks or month is it safe to plan a trip where there will be no snow?
I mean, you know, it's safe to go on the 14th of June if you're well equipped. I mean, yes, you might encounter snow, but I'm not saying it's not safe. There are certain variants that you mustn't do in June. However, if they want lush green kind of mountains and no snow on the trail, then it's around about, I would say, around the 7th of July, Ollie, would you agree? Something like that for...
Yeah.
And it all depends on how much snow has fallen and the melt rate in spring. But I would say kind of from after the first week of July onwards.
Okay. All right. That makes sense. Max, on your website, it says that the most common feedback from your Zoom clients are that they underestimate the elevation. And you go on to say the more you train, the more you will enjoy the trek. Let's have you both just comment on that. And then we're going to segue a little into fitness.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. I think that the single aspect of the trail that people underestimate is the elevation. So combined elevation is actually higher than Everest. So most people don't train enough for the elevation. And then they're almost surprised at the fact that they will be literally going up and down every single day. So I think it's really, really important that people train adequately. Some people can find that hard because they haven't got hills around where they live, where they can train. You know, training is a really, really important aspect.
We'll get into the details of that in a sec, so we can talk about that. Ollie, any comments on that? Or should we just get into the training?
No, I mean, very similar. I think one of the sort of highest dropout reasons is things like knee pain or ankle pain from, to be honest, mostly the descents. People can sort of power on slowly and achieve the ascents, which are typically in the morning. So you're a bit fresher, you know, you've just had breakfast, so you had a coffee, you're ready to go. But actually in the afternoon when you're fatigued and you've got, let's say, 1,000 meters, 3,000 feet descent to do late afternoon, you know, it's a lot of pressure on your knees, on your ankles, especially if you have a heavy backpack. And typically that's when people experience some difficulties.
Okay. All right. So let's segue into talking about what I call the Fit for Trips Big Five. It's a hiking strategy, or it's a training strategy that I teach all my clients that detail five pillars that make up a hiking training. And so I want to share them with you so that we can kind of flush out some important training strategies the listeners can implement. So number one, walk inclines. Two, walk stairs. Three, walk lunges. Four, walk far. And then five, HIIT training. So I recommend walk inclines. And by the way, most people don't have access to actually hiking trails, or they're restricted by a typical work schedule and all they can do is get out and hike on a weekend, if they even have that available. So by walking inclines, I need them to lengthen their Achilles and calf and plantar fascia to be able to tolerate all the ascents on the TMB so they don't develop any kind of acute tendonitis or anything like that. And then on the stairs, I recommend that because it's a very aggressive climb. If you look at the handrail on the stairs, you see how steep it is, which would be a very difficult hike. It would be more like scrambling. But because of the flat part of the stairs, you have the advantage to be able to ascend. You're developing strength and endurance going up. And then when you come down, that's a great opportunity to really develop and acclimate to that kind of stress to be able to tolerate going down the hills, you know, on the TMB. So you got the stairs. Walk lunges is more of a catch-all term for just leg strength in general, whether it's step-ups, walk lunges, deadlifts, things like that. And then there's walking far, which is all relative, but you know, you still have to get used to tens of thousands of steps that you'll be taking on the trail. And then the last one is HIIT training, which we don't have to get into, but starting at inclines on your site, you say double hills equal double fitness. So we can really take this anywhere we want. We could start with talking about hills. We could talk about stairs. We'll just use those five as a reference and let's just have a chat about what people should have a takeaway to get what strategies they should use to prepare.
Yeah, I think it's never too early. Once you've decided to do the Tour de Mont Blanc and you've made your reservations and you're definitely doing it, then I think it's never too early to start training, whether that be, you know, I mean, obviously depends on your current fitness, but just getting out there and trying to get on and whatever trail and any incline that you can get to is definitely going to help.
Yeah, absolutely. And typically we notice the planning period for people to do a trip like this is fairly far in advance, especially now with the refuges booking up early. So people typically planning a trip like this sort of 8 to 12 months ahead, giving a decent amount of time to sort of get into shape. And everything you mentioned is great. The more the better, I guess. And I guess perhaps we'll touch on it later, but there's sort of the mental aspect of it as well. With every day for 10 to 11 days, you're getting up in the morning and you're doing elevation up, elevation down, and you can train really well for that. But if, I think it was the number five on your list.
The HIIT training.
Number four then.
Walking
far. Yeah. I think that's actually underrated to go out for long hikes and sort of persevere, you know, develop a bit of perseverance there, because once you hit day five, day six, day seven, you're getting up again, you're doing another 1,000 meters of elevation. So to be used to doing that,
yeah,
is super useful.
I think time on the trail and doing back-to-back days, even if it's just 2 days back-to-back, you know, they're going away for the weekend or 3 days, just trying to get your body accustomed to getting up again and doing it again even if it's 2 or 3 days, is gonna really benefit you. Also, training with a backpack, even if it is just a short walk here and there, training with the backpack that you're aiming to take on the trail with weight in it is really important.
Yeah, and just for the listeners who don't have access to trails, I don't want you to be discouraged. The stairs and the treadmill, and even if you have access to hills, that's where you can really train vertically. And if all you have is horizontal for miles on end, and as Mag said, to throw on a heavy backpack and, you know, and just go.
Yeah, you
many,
know,
many
lunges,
miles. Yeah.
Sorry, lunges and squats, I mean, absolutely brilliant. Always, always training, doing those. And, you know, you don't need hills for those. They're definitely going to help you if you haven't got any hills. But yeah, don't underestimate what you can do just in your own house.
Yeah, exactly. And something else you say on your website, regarding stairs, you say, start only taking the stairs wherever you go, whether that's in your house, your office, or the department store. Think of the stairs instead of the elevator from this moment on will help your cause tenfold. I think if there's one thing that you can do aside from hiking, I would say the stairs. You guys want to comment on that?
Yeah, absolutely. You can't underestimate that. And doing it obviously for a significant amount of time and also finding your pace, a pace that you're comfortable with. Got to remember that, you know, you're hiking for 3, 4, 5 hours at a time uphill, potentially on some days with a few rests in between, but sort of not running up and down stairs as quickly as you can, but finding a good pace and staying consistent to that pace as opposed to, you know, going quicker for half an hour and then slower for 20 minutes. Find a steady pace that you can maintain for hours on end.
And also trying to walk everywhere rather than taking the bus. You know, if it's a realistic distance that you can walk, try and walk it instead of taking the short distances with a car or a bus.
Yeah, that makes sense. Let's see how much more we can flesh out about fitness and then we'll kind of move on. What's the most common fitness question that you guys get?
I actually don't get many fitness questions. People are worried about fitness and I tell them to start early and, you know, I have some exercises on the website or whatever, but nobody actually focuses on fitness with me specifically during my Zooms. I don't know about you, Ollie, with guests.
No, nothing in particular. I mean, some people, they give us a history of their own fitness. So they'll tell us, you know, that I've run a marathon recently, I've done this or that, or I've done this competition or this previous trek. How does that compare to this? We offer advice on that. As for specific fitness concerns, nothing springs to mind.
Okay. So it sounds like they do their research. They look at you guys for logistics and trip details, and then they go ahead and research the fitness on their own, which makes sense.
Yeah.
Do you find different, this is just something I'm curious about, do you find different fitness levels between self-guided and guided travelers? Because it's a different mindset. Do you find one is more fit than the other? Just as kind of a warning and a caveat, like you're going to go guided versus not guided. It's still the same type of preparation. But anyway.
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. I can't really answer that because I don't deal with guided groups. But Ollie?
Yeah, I don't know. I suppose the general feeling we get is self-guided customers, they do a little bit more research themselves and look into it a little bit further because they know that they'll, you know, ultimately taking themselves along the trail. So I think you could probably argue that they're perhaps maybe slightly better prepared physically, training-wise, whereas perhaps a guided mentality is, you know, I'll be led on this trek. I can follow the lead as opposed to sort of take the initiative. So yeah, I don't think there's a huge difference between the two, but perhaps self-guided customers are slightly better prepared from that standpoint.
Interesting. What's the biggest surprise that most people experience on the TMB?
The elevation, I think. I mean, it's all there in black and white. If people look, you know.
We keep coming back to that. Okay, guys.
Sorry. And also the snow and early season, I would say. I think they're the two for me.
Okay.
Yeah. So, you have different types. You have positive surprises and negative ones, right? So I think positive surprise for people is the variety of you know, the three different countries, the different types of trails that people will encounter. A lot of the TMB is well-trodden. You do have sections which are sort of pretty rough and ready. You have certain variants that trails are, you know, not technical when it comes to sort of discussing mountaineering routes, but if you're looking at the technical scale of a trekking trail, some variants would be sort of on the higher end of that. You have uneven ground, sort of shingle, slippery. We've definitely had people do some of the variants and feedback to us that they were surprised at how varied everything was. And yeah, of course, the elevation sneaks up on people too.
I agree about the positive aspect is a lot of feedback from my Zoom clients are, just being so surprised at how beautiful, how staggeringly beautiful it is. Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm glad you segued to the positive. And what I don't want people to get the impression of is that this is, you know, it's so hard, don't try it. The point of me flushing out this is because we stated at the very beginning how amazing this is. And just making sure that people are aware of the physical challenges is, I think, a positive, because we want them to experience them. And at the end, we want good feedback. We want good testimonials. We want people to visit. And sometimes if they don't prepare and they have a bad experience, then they're just not going to share it. They might be embarrassed. They might even speak poorly of you guys, which is unfair, but it's just the nature of it. So we're just telling people, look, it's not a big deal. It's a science. Just get physically prepared for it and you'll have, you know, one of the best hikes of your life. So I'm glad you bring up the positive, because that's why we're talking about this.
I think it, absolutely. The fitter that you can be and the preparations that you make will enable you to enjoy it to the absolute maximum. I truly believe that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, the more you can be prepared. I mean, you don't want to get to the top of, you know, one of the viewpoints, one of the coals, and you're suffering. You know, you want to be able to reach top and sit down, enjoy the views, as opposed to just, you know, looking down and catching your breath for half an hour. So yeah, prepare as much as you can.
Let's describe the two most challenging stages in terms of elevation gain in miles, just to have some objective numbers here.
I would say one of the most challenging on the traditional route is stage two, which you need to climb two cols on that day, the Col de Bonhomme and the Col de la Croix de Bonhomme. So that's 1,300 meters of up. So I think that is the most challenging day on the general traditional route. And I would say the second one would be the variant stage eight. Ollie, would you agree, on the Fenet d'Arpet, which you got to an elevation of 2,665 meters, which is joint equal with Col de Four. So that's the highest point on the trail. And that is, as Ollie was describing, some of the more technical aspects of the variants. That's very kind of very shady, very kind of high up the trail, is no longer a trail. Actually climbing over a boulder field for the hour before you get to the top of the col. So I think, in my opinion, it would be stage two on the traditional, and then variant stage eight if trekkers were going to take that variant.
Yeah, completely agree. The same two come to mind. It's coupled, isn't it? So you have the longest distance up and down combined with most uneven terrain. So on the way up to the Col de Bonhomme as well, the terrain is fairly uneven and it's a lot rockier than the trail leading up to it, and that you would hike in the morning. So when you get past Refuge de la Balme, it's a bit spicy. So yeah, it's a combination of those two factors that make those stages really difficult.
Okay. So let's segue into the variant options. So which are the most popular and why? And what percentage of hikers actually take on the variant, one variant or more? Just, I don't need an exact percentage, but, you know, do most people try at least one, or most people do not?
I think Max was about to say something about the Col de Tricot being the
a classic now. I actively encourage my clients to take variant stage one via the Col de Tricot. So obviously it's a little bit more demanding than the traditional stage, but I think the views are worth it. And it's not, well, basically it's the easiest variant, I would say, on the TMB, and it's definitely worth it for the amount of effort that you have to put in. It's actually the only safe variant to do early season as well. And I think most people now do that variant rather than the traditional route through the forest. You can't do it in bad weather, so you would have to revert to the traditional trail in bad weather. But the variant trail, it crosses the only Himalayan suspension bridge on the TMB, and it goes up via, well, you get a really good view of the glacier to BNSA, staggering views, and you get the view of the Dôme de Miage as well. So that's, in my opinion, it's one of the best variants to do. Would you agree, Ollie?
Yeah, completely. We, even though it is officially a variant, we kind of sort of speak about it as the normal route these days. Like Max said, even early June, I mean, and of course, unless there's an exceptional snow year, but the descent is facing south. So any snow that sort of remaining there will melt off fairly quickly. And it's stunning. It really is, like, it's so beautiful when you go over that col and down into sort of where the Chalets de Miage are, stop for a blueberry tart there, and then continue down to wherever you might be staying, or you might be lucky enough to stay there. So yeah, that's a top recommendation we encourage everyone to do. I think then they sort of dwindle off a bit in popularity. There's, you know, the real keen hikers want to try and do them all. So you have Col de Four coming up, which can be tricky, especially early season. It's high, it's not really facing south, the descent, so can be some snow there. And in the past, there's been some incidents there with people getting into trouble. So the trail's pretty slippery and uneven. And then I guess the other sort of popular or bigger name is the Fenet d'Arpet on stage 8 from Champey to Trion. Again, that's sort of for the diehards. Like we were saying earlier, there's a boulder field which you have to navigate through. And then the descent again is fairly steep, can be slippery, you know, not advisable in bad weather, especially when it's wet. But they are beautiful, you know, they are. I think the difference between the Col de Tricot and the normal route is quite big, whereas opposed to the other ones, the normal route is also really nice. So you have the bovine route, which is kind of the classic way, and that's stunning in its own right. So it's not like you're missing out on something by doing the variant. You know, you have two good choices for those days.
Sorry, can I just jump in here? I would say the least trodden variant is the variant stage 9, which I absolutely love. I'm just writing a post on it now. And I think, I mean, I rarely see anyone on that section. It's just stunning. You go via the Refuge Le Grand. So yeah, that's one that I encourage people to take, even if the hardcore often take the variant stage 8 and 9 together. But even if you take just the variant 9 trail from Trient, I've had some clients recently that are chopping up the trail into really small segments, and they're just going to do the variant trail from Trient up to the Refuge Col de Balme. And it's such a lovely, lovely variant, and you rarely, rarely see anyone on it. So I fully recommend that one.
The more you read about the TMB, you read so frequently how well the trail is marked and how easy it is to navigate. Does the same apply to the variants?
I think so, to a degree, yeah. I think the only sort of main differences is once you get towards the higher terrain on, say, the Col de Four and the Fenet d'Arpet, it does get a little bit trickier. They have sort of markings on the rocks as opposed to, you know, really nice, clear signposts at some stages. But I think with a bit of research and some support, then people don't tend to get lost on those.
No, the TMB is very, very clearly marked. I mean, I would say it's only variant stage 8, like you say, with the paint, you have splashes of paint. I think that's the only one that's quite difficult. And also the Col de Four variant, if you're doing it early season, which I never recommend anyone to do it early season, because it's just dangerous. There's a lot of torrents, glacial torrents coming down, and they have snow bridges that are very easily, you know, they can collapse.
All right, makes sense. For the listener, just define col, what a col is.
A col is a mountain pass. I do get that question quite a lot. Because we live in the French Alps, we just assume everybody kind of knows it. But yes, col is a mountain pass.
Okay. All right, let's talk about strategies for reducing pack weight, including options for restocking daily or getting primary meals at a refuge. Kind of what would be a good target weight to aim for in different scenarios? We could get into weight if you want, or we don't have to be that specific. You could talk about the options that you can bring your food and you can prepare food along the way, or you can restock at each town or refuge, or you can eat your meals there and just snack along the way. What are your thoughts on that?
This comes up a lot, and often people set off for day one and day two with, you know, all kinds of protein bars and snacks and supplies, and they realize that actually you can buy most of that stuff as you go. And at some point they're then looking to get rid of, you know, all this extra weight that they've been carrying. We highly recommend to people to just try and pack as light as they can. So what does that mean? That means cutting down on snacks and all that kind of stuff. You can buy as you go. There's towns on the way. There's refuges that you pass. You can stop and buy a cake instead of eating a snack that you've brought. You can stop and buy lunch on the trails. And that's also part of the TMB, I find, to go into these little refuges on the way, experience them and sit down and have a traditional meal. You need to cover the basics, obviously. So water, you know, 1.5 to 2 liters of water you should be carrying. Again, you can fill up water as you go, but you don't really want to be setting off carrying more than 2 liters. Of course, that's one of the heavier things that you can have in your backpack. There's other ways to sort of cut down. A lot of people tend to use luggage transfers these days. So there are some really well-run companies locally who will offer to take your main bag around to different stages. Of course, they can't get to some of the higher refuges, so you need to be a bit strategic with your planning. You know, if you're looking to be reunited with your bag every day, you want to be staying lower down or even in hotels in towns so that you can access your bag. But in general, people do a bit of a mix. So you have your day bag with your essentials in and have your bag transferred maybe to every second or third spot along the way. And then, you know, you can reunite with your clothes, you can change a couple of items. But yeah, of course, there's the purists who want to do the whole thing with their backpack, and that's great. But yeah, if that's the case, then just really, if you have a doubt or if you're 50-50 about an item, then chances are you don't need it. You know, you don't need all of these t-shirts, all of these jumpers, all of these. You just really need a solid waterproof layer, top and bottom, and then some lightweight trekking clothing, water, and a couple of snacks. That's really it.
I would say if I'm carrying everything in my pack, I would normally put a 10 kg limit on there, lower if I can, if I can get it down to 7, and that's really good. It's layers that you need and technical layers. You know, people often say, what's the temperature going to be? Do I need everything? Yes, you absolutely need everything. These are mountain conditions. They can, you know, the conditions can change very, very quickly. But there's plenty of opportunity to kind of wash out thermals and t-shirts. I always carry some of the small carabiners on my pack so that if I wash something out, literally the next day, you know, if I'm hiking, pop it on the carabiner on my rucksack, it'll be dry by the time I get to the next refuge. So yeah, you know, obviously toiletries, just take as little as possible because, you know, we've all had it. We've all kind of packed a massive bag and it feels okay when you leave. And then 3 days, you know, not even 3 days, like 3 hours later, it just feels like you've got bricks in your backpack. So I now am very, very brutal with what I take, the absolute bare minimum. And if you can't do that, then you're going to have to take a luggage transfer.
Okay. All right. Makes sense. So I'm going to have you guys comment on this. I think we can flesh out a little bit more. This might sound like a repeat, but I think we can garner some more information. So the Tour Mont Blanc Trail starting in Chamonix and the French Alps is broken up into 11 stages that folks can tackle any which way they want. While the entire circuit takes 10 to 11 days, the flexibility of having numerous start points on the trail enables hikers to enjoy the trail for any number of days from just a one-day hike, a long weekend, or a week. And I think that was on your website, Mags. You guys have some thoughts on that? I don't think we had covered that. It's 11 stages, putting that out there so that people understand that. And then we can talk about how people attack the trail. Maybe yeah. We can even talk about, you know, clockwise versus counterclockwise. I want to get into that.
Yeah, so there are 11 stages on the TMB, but there are refuges every 5 kilometers. So people don't need to get fixated on the 11 stages, you know, if they don't want to do it. In 10 or 11 days, they don't have to. They can split it up as many, you know, different ways as they want. There are lots of access points. So the beauty is, yes, you can kind of enter into the TMB trail at any point, really. Not at any point, but, you know, several different points. Two of the stages 10 and 11, run alongside the Chamonix Valley. So they're very, very easy to access. And so, yeah, I mean, I love the fact you can do 3 or 4 days from Chamonix to Courmayeur. That's one of my favorite itineraries. So you could do that at a stretch in 3 days. If not, it's 4 days. There's actually not a lot of people know that there's a tunnel under Mont Blanc. So you can actually get the bus back from Courmayeur, which is the big Italian town on the other side of Mont Blanc. And you can be back in Chamonix 45 minutes later. So it's very easy to do kind of the first 4 days, the first half of the trail. And I think it's great that people can, they don't have to do the 10 or 11 days. Once you enter the trail, you're not trapped on it. You know, that's it. You know, you can exit. There's quite a few exit points. And also a lot of people tend to come and do half the trail 1 year and come back and finish the trail the following year. I mean, it's, you know, I know, especially for Americans, you know, holiday, they don't have much holiday time. So I get lots of clients that come and do kind of the first half 1 year and then they finish it the next year.
Okay, that makes sense. Ollie, any thoughts on that?
Not really, to be honest, no. I think you mentioned briefly about sort of clockwise and anti-clockwise. There's certainly pros and cons about each. I think sort of going anti-clockwise, the sort of traditional way, you tend to keep Mont Blanc sort of, you know, on your left-hand side and a bit more in sight. You saying that, I mean, people who go clockwise, there's different ways of looking at it. You cross loads of people at a certain point in the day and then sort of not really see anybody. Whereas if you're going anti-clockwise, your chances are you'll see a lot of the same people in different refuges. You make friends, you sort of see the same people as you go. So I don't know, Mags, why is anti-clockwise the official way?
It's the views of Mont Blanc better anti-clockwise. However, there are a lot of people on the trail now, especially since COVID. So, you know, if you would prefer to be away from people, then it would be good to do it the opposite way around. Yeah, I mean, or trek on the shoulder seasons, you know? I mean, it's still beautiful whichever way. It's just, you know, I guess some of the cols I don't particularly like hiking the other way around. Don't like going up the Col de Trico from Refuge Mirage, for example. You know, there are pros and cons to it. You know, I think certainly Ollie, if you were hiking kind of 11 and doing 11 and then 10, you would kind of have your back to Mont Blanc, which isn't ideal. Yeah, I think that's generally why people trek anti-clockwise, but it is very busy doing it that way. And often we haven't discussed really about how difficult it is to book the TMB refuges, and you have to book them extremely early now because it's so popular. If you switch direction, you can often find availability in the refuges. So that's a good trick. If people are trying to book independently, can work to your favor doing that sometimes.
Okay, makes sense. Some people who want to experience this kind of, let's call it wilderness or mountains, not everybody likes to pitch a tent. But I think one thing that's really nice about this is the network of mountain huts and refuges and small villages.
It can be quite difficult sometimes to camp the trail because you have different camping restrictions according to which country you're in. So with France, it's not a problem. Wild camping is permitted from dusk till dawn. So France is easy and beautiful to camp in. When you go into Italy, it's only legal above 2,500 meters. So that's very difficult on the trail in Italy. Otherwise, you need to be in a permitted camping zones, of which there are few in that section, really. And then Switzerland, you have to be in, you know, permitted area. So that is campsite, basically. So it just changes a little bit. I mean, what's lovely about camping the trail is the freedom that it allows, you know, as in you're not booked into a refuge. So if you arrive, you get to that refuge kind of earlier, you can carry on kind of walking. But you still, you know, unless you're in France, you don't have that freedom of just setting up and kind of camping wherever. It also changes a little bit about provisions on the trail. So as Ollie will tell you, and this is the beauty of the TMB, is that every refuge is different and every refuge owner is different. And some refuges, you can have dinner there, just dinner. You know, you can camp next door and have dinner. Other refuges, absolutely not, you know. So you haven't got a consistency throughout the trail with that. So even if you're camping, you kind of really need to research it. A lot of people get worried about provisions. And yes, you know, you do need to know where you can provision, where you can't. And, you know, there are some, for example, Lac Blanc, which is one of the most beautiful places to go to on the trail. You are not allowed to camp there and they will not feed you. So if you get caught out, I actually know an American family that got caught out. I would have obviously advised them, but I didn't speak to them before they went. They really got caught out that evening and they actually didn't end up eating. So you do still need to do a lot of research, even if you're camping along the trail.
Okay. And for those who don't want to camp, there are options at every stage. Is that correct?
The variety all along the TMB caters for everybody. So we have certain customers who are, you know, keen to stay in nice hotels. So you have Courmayeur, Le Contamine, Le Chapeau. You can transfer down to a nearby town called Bourg-Saint-Maurice. Then you've got Courmayeur and La Fouly, Champey, Trian, Argentière. So you, for that sort of type of demand, people can be well served. But the refuges are what make the TMB unique and special, and they are really amazing to sample. Also, the difference between the French, sort of Italian, Swiss refuges and huts, and the different food on offer, like Mag says, the different owners, the different staff, the language. It's, yeah, we always highly recommend people to experience that. Even if it's not for every night, you know, got to spend a few nights in these refuges there. I know for North Americans, it's quite an unusual thing, I think, to have a mountain refuge that's fully catered and people living up there all summer, cooking food, making the beds, pouring beer. You know, you can drink wine there. You can have a cheese board, a charcuterie plate. You can, you know, you're sitting up at 2,000 meters watching the sun go down, drinking a glass of wine. One thing really to say about refuges is just manage your expectations. So sleeping arrangements are usually very basic and they're shared. Some refuges do have private smaller rooms, but they're very hard to come by and then they get booked up very early. So if that is what you're after, then we always recommend, you know, inquire and book very, very early. But I think once you manage people's expectations and you're staying in this You know, for example, the Refuge Bonhomme is beautifully located at the top of the Col du Croix de Bonhomme, but it's basic. You know, it's at almost 2,500 meters. The food is flown in by helicopter. You know, running water barely exists. There's shower if you're lucky. Sometimes it doesn't work. But once you realize that you're in this hut and these people have prepared you a three-course evening meal and you take it for what it is, then that's kind of the memory of the TMB, you know. So yeah, I highly recommend people to experience that.
Absolutely. I love having dinner in the huts and chatting with all the other hikers. It's lovely. It really is. And especially in Refuge Col du Croix, they have dinner by candlelight because they have solar power. So they switch that off and they use candlelight. And it's such a wonderful ambience to be chatting, you know, with all these different hikers from all over the world, every nationality you could think of. And it's wonderful, some of the people you meet. And if you're all hiking, normally you'll see the same people, you know, maybe you'll see them and you'll stay at the same refuges. So you can actually walk away with really good friends for life after you've been to the TMB.
Okay. Out of curiosity, what percentage are Americans that book with you guys?
Oh, that's a good question. I would say approximately 30% now. We have a bunch of Europeans, people from the UK, and that number's growing, by the way. I think that's going up. So more and more North Americans are traveling over. Of course, now there's no restrictions. There was restrictions for a while. The summer just gone was very, very busy with North America.
And for me, it's about 80%. 80% of my Zoom clients are American. Yeah. So, yeah, the majority.
Interesting. One last thing, and then we'll kind of wrap up. So I think this is on your website, Mags, I think. On stage 10, the standard route includes a series of 13 metal ladders, which in practice is not really an issue. It sounds scarier than it is, unless, of course, you suffer from vertigo. In this case, there's an alternative route that you can take to avoid the ladders. Any comments on that? Not a big deal?
Yeah, absolutely. It's not a big deal unless you suffer from vertigo. If you don't like heights, then I would suggest not doing it. What I advise clients is to have a look on YouTube. Put in stage 10 TMB ladders and you will see some videos and you can make a decision, because what you don't want to do is set off on, because it's on the traditional stage 10. So you'd set off and it takes about an hour and a half to get to the first ladder. So if you hike to the first ladder and then you have a look and you go, oh, I don't want to do that, it's going to take you about another hour to get down. And then the alternative route takes about an extra hour than the ladder route. So, you know, you could have added kind of three and a half hours to your day just by doing that. So I would definitely kind of have a little bit of a research, have a look at the photos and the videos online. I think Adventure Base are about to make.
Stay tuned.
A little video on the ladders. Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, it's very, very easy to take the alternative route. You just carry on walking up the col, which is the main kind of big road that passes over the col there. So you just walk up for 20-25 minutes, and it's very, very clearly marked, the alternative trail. But this is stage 10. It's beautiful. It's in a national reserve, so you've got a really, really good chance of seeing the ibex and the chamois on the way up to Lac Blanc. It's a beautiful, beautiful trail. The ladders do get quite busy, and sometimes you get people coming the opposite way, so there can be queues. And, you know, my kids do them. They love them. It's all depends on your disposition with heights.
Okay. All right.
They're not actually scary. There's only a couple of long ladders, and, you know, some of them are at a 45-degree angle, which kind of makes them feel a bit safer, and they are very safe. So in Italy, you know, you have some of the trails, and they're actually, some of the trails aren't very well maintained, but the TMB is very, very well maintained. The ladders are very safe. You know, obviously attach your hiking poles to your backpack, so you've got two hands, and yeah. It's not such a big deal unless you've got an issue with heights, I would say.
Okay. All right. Well, I think we're going to kind of wrap it up. So my goal today was to make sure that people are confident. You know, after listening to this, they've got the confidence. They're like, okay, I'm going to add the TMB to my bucket list. I can contact Marcus for some fitness. I can contact Ollie for guided trails. I can contact Mags for information about self-guided tours. So I think we hit the mark today. So Mags, I hope people contact you. I think you've established a lot of credibility in this discussion. And on your website, you say this. You say, I've planned two family Tour de Mont Blanc itineraries with much shorter stages to help with little legs for families hiking the Tour de Mont Blanc. I've also included several itineraries for super fit trekkers or fast packers and an itinerary for adventure seekers set on staying in high mountain huts, and of course, the full 11-day Tour de Mont Blanc itinerary, a variant TMB itinerary, which is, as the name suggests, follows all the variant trails, and the half tour itineraries too. So, any comment on that? You know it all, Mags.
Yeah, I mean, we know the trail intimately. We live here. It's daily part of our lives, really. And what I do love doing, especially with my Zoom clients, is making bespoke trips. It's very, very easy for us to say, hey, what are your requirements? What do you want? Let us plan it for you. And like I say, there are refuges every 5 kilometers along the trail. So there's no rule, you know, you don't have to stick to a 4-day, a 6-day, a 9-day, whatever. It's how far do you want to walk? Do you want to take in the best bits? Oh, you've got a 10-year-old, you know, let's make it happen, really. I think the TMB is accessible for anyone. I have, you know, I have a Zoom client tonight with a lady in her 60s and a man in his 70s. And, you know, I often see people kind of into older ages on the trail. And I think it's fantastic to see people enjoying the trail. What I would just say before we kind of finish off is that there are a lot of transport options on the TMB that can make it easier. And these are generally only open in July and August. So if people are wanting to take a cable car for a descent, for example, to save their knees, then it should be July or August they should be planning it for.
Okay. And Ali, I hope the listeners will contact you on the Adventure Base website. On the site, it reads, "We believe the future belongs to those that do. That's why we build adventures in stunning environments, inspiring us to dream big and live more. Our trips are not easy, but the best thing in life aren't. Save your effort for the adventure. We'll do the rest, and we pride ourselves on getting the details right and the trip ready." Yeah, I mean, I think you've established a lot of credibility as well. But you guys offer more than TMB itineraries, which we don't need to get into detail now, but just want to share some of that information.
Yeah, sure. So we're based in Chamonix, and we cover sort of three main disciplines, trekking being the main focus, but we also do mountaineering. So for any listeners that are interested in potentially summiting Mont Blanc, they'll do the trek first and become inspired by reaching the top someday. We facilitate that throughout the summer months too, and then during the winter months we do skiing as well. So all year round sort of adventure experiences in the Alps.
Okay,
and I've got a couple of new sites about to launch actually on various different trekking trails in Europe. So we're writing one about to launch on the West Highland Way in Scotland. And soon I'll be hiking the Dolomites, the AV1 trail, the Altavir 1 trail, and also the Laugavegur trail in Iceland. So there's lots going on. There's some amazing treks in the whole of Europe. And yeah, it's great to see people out on the trail. And I know, trekking is a bug. Once you've done one multi-day, mm-hmm, long-distance trek, you're looking for the next. So, yeah.
Yeah, true.
Okay, and so any specifics about where they should contact you, Mags?
No, just onto my website. So it's www.tourdemontblanchike.com. And you can see me on there to organize a Zoom or just, you know, get in touch about a self-guided trek.
Okay, and Ollie?
Yeah, just our website, adventurebase.com. And if someone wants to drop us an email, just hello@adventurebase.com, and we'd love to chat.
Okay. And for me, fitfortrips.com/consultation. And that way we can have a chat, and hopefully you'll add the TMB to your bucket list. Anyway, it's been a pleasure meeting you guys. Thank you. I know it's the end of your work day. For me, it's 11 a.m. And for you guys, what time is it?
It's just gone 4 o'clock in the afternoon.
Okay. I guess kind of capping off work and heading out for an evening meal, perhaps, maybe.
Yeah, I can see it's beautiful outside. Thanks for having us, Marcus.
Yes, thank you. It's been a pleasure. Thanks for your time.
Thanks a lot.
It's good to meet you both. That concludes this episode of the Hike Strong podcast. I'm committed to keeping all of the episodes for free. All I ask is that you subscribe to the podcast and leave a review. And don't forget to share this podcast with your friends. My goal is to build a vast community of hikers with the confidence to crush any local or global trail. I hope you will join me in this endeavor. So until next time, train, hike, repeat, and as always, I'm here to support you every step of the way.